Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
You are listening to station WGN.
Oh, a microphony.
And a phony at the mic. Whoa!
And radio became an accepted vehicle for nationwide news and opinion.
Notify all radio and TV stations to broadcast the following message.
Oh, is that the comedy spot?
No, Bubblehead, this is a comedy spot.
You're a fun guy, Dave. You're lonely on an island.
What a dope. What a maroon.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is exciting, isn't it?
5, 4, 3, 2. It's that time of the year for Dave Plyer's favorite conversations of the year on 720 WGN. And now, live from the Skyline Studios, here's Dave.
Welcome in, everybody. It's nice to be with you. So tonight is another collection of my favorite conversations of the year. Now, one of the most iconic figures in pop culture of the 70s, 80s, and beyond is Olivia Newton-John. We'll talk to her about the 40th anniversary of Grease and her recent battle with stage 4 cancer. She's an amazing woman, and we'll talk to her about that and much more. Plus, we'll talk to Christopher Knight, Peter Brady of the Brady Bunch on the series' 50th anniversary and their newest HGTV series, which was a huge hit a few months back, A Very Brady Renovation. You'll hear from George Schlatter, who created the TV series Laugh-In, a precursor to shows like Saturday Night Live, and a spirited conversation about classic TV with WGN TV's Larry Potash and Mike Toomey. But first, the legendary Olivia Newton-John. Plyer back with you here on 720 WGN. So for more than five decades, Olivia Newton-John has been one of our most successful and adored entertainers. A four-time Grammy Award winner, she is one of the world's best-selling recording artists of all time with more than 100 million albums sold. Her starring roles in the iconic movie Grease catapulted her into superstardom. And in addition to her music and screen successes, Olivia is perhaps best known for her strength, her courage, and her grace. After her own personal journeys with cancer, she has thrived and become an inspiration for millions around the world. Now, she's sharing her journey in her new book, Don't Stop Believin', and she is so sweet to take some time for us tonight. Olivia, welcome in.
Thank you for that beautiful introduction.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I got to tell you, I don't know who didn't have a crush on Olivia Newton-John at some point in their life, right?
I don't know about that, but thanks.
Absolutely, absolutely. So congrats, first of all, on the new book. Spectacular. And it was a long time coming, too. When you were writing, what was it like looking back at life's beautiful journey and such an amazing five-decade-long career?
Well, I think you've said it, really. I'm really grateful, and I can't believe a lot of the things that I've done and how many things I've done. I've had so many different lifetimes. And I feel just very, very fortunate.
So when I was looking online just at some of your earliest performances, I was looking at stuff from the early 1960s, which I don't think I've ever seen before. Because you're right. You have hit, you know, so many decades, right, in different lives, like just different reincarnations. And there was a show called Sing 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 in Australia.
You found that, really?
I found that, yeah. Wow. And you won a talent show. I think you went to England because of that show, right?
That's right. Sing 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 was, I think I was 15, and it was a national television show, and the host was kind of like the Elvis of Australia. His name is Johnny O'Keefe. And I went on the show, and I, much to my amazement, won the whole thing, and the prize was a trip to England on a boat, on a ship.
Wow.
So a year later, my mother dragged me kicking and screaming to England. That really started everything. And, even though I fought my mum at the time, I'm very grateful to her now for that decision.
That's awesome. And, I mean, you kept going. You went and formed an all-girl group. You teamed up with your friend, Pat, who I knew you're still good friends with, Pat and Olivia. And you met on another show called The Go Show. So there was a lot of great music shows back in the 1960s, even in your neck of the woods.
The Go Show. Well, that was Australian TV. That was the local television show. So Sing 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 and The Go Show were kind of the hot TV shows in Australia when I was young. And Bandstand, something called Bandstand. And we didn't really have television. I think maybe we just got a TV, but I hardly watched it. So I don't really know other ones from America, for instance.
So when you were on TV, family and friends probably at that early on didn't see you at that time. Because, I mean, TVs were pretty rare, right?
Yeah, not everyone had a TV then. But I got great experience because I would, we would tape a show and then do one live every day. I was on an afternoon show. And so I learned a lot from, those early days in Australia. It was my training ground.
Things moved very fast for you because I know you cut your first single for Decca in like 66, and then in the early 70s, 71, you recorded that cover of Bob Dylan's If Not For You. That was huge.
That was a big hit, and it was really weird because I didn't like the song, and I was wrong. And now I love it, and it's interesting because my husband, it's his favorite song. Who would have guessed, right?
I would hope so, yeah,
and,
I was going to say.
It changed the whole thing for me. But it did really well for me, and my manager and my producers kind of encouraged me to record it, and they were right. It worked for my voice really well.
Do you remember where you were when you heard one of your songs on the radio? Was it that one? And because that's got to tell you right there that you made it. You're driving around the street in your car, and all of a sudden, boom, you're on the air.
I think I was in a taxi in America, and it may have been somewhere like Chicago. But I can't remember where exactly, but I remember being in the back seat and going, wow, there it is. And that was one of those moments. I should have written it down, of course.
That's awesome. You had your U.S. album debut with Let Me Be There, first top 10 single of the same name. And right there, I mean, so stardom is moving very fast for you. And you win your first of four Grammys right then.
Yes. And I think that's the one that's missing. I'm very grateful. I have four Grammys, but I only have three. And I don't know what happened to the
first
one. I think that's the one that's missing. So,
that's the first one.
Yeah. It's amazing. Let Me Be There and If You Love Me, Let Me Know and Please, Mr. Please were all written by one man, John Rostall, who was English and sadly died and never got to know about the success of his songs. But he wrote some incredible songs, and here he was, this English bass player.
Wow!
Yeah.
And is that somebody you chose to write the music, or was it the record label at the time?
No, Bruce Welch, who was producing me, who was my boyfriend at that time. Mm-hmm. He and John Farrar produced me, and Bruce found these songs because he was in a band with John Rostall. So that's how that happened.
Well, we are talking to music icon Olivia Newton-John, and there's more coming up next on 720 WGN.
Love, the echoes of long ago. You needed the world to know they are in Xanadu. week on Chicago's Best. For some, getting rid of grains is a choice. For others, it's a lifestyle. Chicago's Best is going gluten-free Sunday night at 10 on WGN-TV.
All right, it's Dave Plyer back with you here on 720 WGN. We're talking to music icon Olivia Newton-John. Hit after hit, and then comes an opportunity to do Grease. You were like 29 years old, and you felt like you were too old for the part.
I did. Isn't it crazy?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's all relative to how old you are. But when I was 29, all I could do was find fault with myself. And now I look back and go, what was I thinking? You know, I looked so young.
You did.
There I was worrying about it. So anyway, it turned out to be great because John Travolta came to talk me into doing it. And then we did a screen test because I was so worried about it. And I was able to see that we had great chemistry, and I could pull it off.
Yeah, I know.
Because none of us were teenagers. We were all, you know, in our 20s. So thank goodness it worked. That's all I can say.
Well, I just find it funny that John had to come out to your house to convince you to even do this, take this role.
I know, isn't it? Yeah, it is funny. You know, I had made a movie in England called Tomorrow. It was a musical, space musical. We were a group that were taken into outer space. And I guess it was a big deal. You know, Dom Kirshner, who did the Monkey
King, yeah.
Harry Saltzman, who did the Bond movies, put this together, and it was supposed to be the biggest thing since sliced bread. And it didn't happen. So I think I was just really apprehensive about doing another film, full stop.
But what I love about it is that, you know, the screen test, I mean, people take screen tests when they're auditioning for a role that, you know, the producer, the director wants to see. You wanted the screen test. You wanted to make sure that this was. That's awesome.
Yeah, well, thank goodness it worked out.
Yeah, it did. And it became like, okay, so, I mean, we all know about Grease. It's 40 plus years old, became the biggest box office hit of 78. The soundtrack album spent 12 weeks at number one that year and yielded three top five singles, including You're the One That I Want and Hopelessly Devoted to You and Summer Nights. So, I mean, did you see this as just a changing point in your life? Because, I mean, you've had incredible successes even leading up to that.
Oh, yes. I think it just catapulted me to a bigger stratosphere.
Yeah.
Being a so-called movie star, just, not just singing, because, you know, I was doing very well with my music at the time, which was another anxiety of mine, that what if it affected my singing career. So it was fantastic, and it opened up a whole new world for me.
That's amazing. And you know what's funny? In the 1970s, I was walking into the studio today, and one of our engineers, chief engineers, Jim Holland, said to me, I was at our other space at Bradley Place, which is the television station. It also housed our radio station. And I worked the boards when Roy Leonard, this is about 1978, 1979, interviewed Olivia in studio.
Oh, wow.
How cool is that?
Yeah, really. Say hi for me.
I will do that. I will do that. You're the One That I Want. And I love this story. And I've heard you tell it before, but you never rehearsed what you were going to do. I mean, you had the hair, the outfit, the makeup, and you were, first of all, you were a little apprehensive about doing it.
I mean, I'd been Sandy One, as I call her, in that kind of the sweet little image girl in the first part of the movie. And then we were trying on the clothes because we were starting filming the next morning. And John was filming the song Sandy, we're at a drive-in.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed late to do my hair and makeup and try on the clothes. And I walked out onto the set and showed the director. And the whole crew turned around and looked at me, and it was like, what? You know, wolf whistles and all that stuff that girls complain about. And I go, girls, don't complain about it, because when they stop, you'll miss them.
That's right. That's right.
And, so that was amazing. And I thought, wow, this is something. I had no idea, you know, it would have that bigger reaction.
But
that was great for my acting, you know?
Sure. Oh, no, absolutely. And I also am confident, because I did too, we had Grease posters up in our room. We had Xanadu posters. We had physical posters up in our room.
Oh,
I mean, of course we did. Oh, my God. I mean, you were America's sweetheart, during that time period. Another Grammy, you were nominated for a Golden Globe as Best Actress in a Musical and performed Hopelessly Devoted to You, which was also nominated for an Oscar at the 1979 Academy Awards. Was that a little nerve-wracking, performing in front of all those fellow actors and actresses?
It was really nerve-wracking. And to top it off, I had a fever, about 103. I had, I didn't know it at the time. You know, I'm always one of those, the show must go on people, but I had a fever and I had hepatitis. And so the next day when I ended up in the hospital, and my doctor called me and said, "Dearie, how many people did you kiss last night? Because we're all going to have a shot."
Oh, no. Oh, no, you poor thing. Oh, no.
So that was my memory of the, I didn't feel my best.
Yeah, yeah. Gotcha, gotcha. Did you, I mean, do you get a lot of people telling you how formative that film was for them?
Yes, it's really incredible that, you know, all these years later, that is the one movie or the one thing in my career that comes up mostly. I mean, Honestly Love You and Xanadu, of course, but Grease is the one that people still talk about it and they still love it. So I feel just very lucky that I'm, you know, a part of that.
Oh, let me tell you, when I told my kids, especially my daughter, I said, you know, I'm going to be interviewing Olivia Newton-John, and immediately she said, "Sandy? You're interviewing Sandy?" Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
It was a big thrill.
Oh, that's nice. You knew my name. That's nice.
Yeah. Yeah. When, you know, you must have realized at some point Grease was going to surpass being a box office hit and become a cultural phenomenon, because you're right. It has lasted 4 decades, and I don't see any end in sight with this movie.
No, I know. It's just something magical about the way that Randall Kleiser, the director, filmed it, and the color and the... And they've upgraded it now. They've just done a whole makeover of the sound, I believe. But it was just something about the energy. And Alan Carr, who was the producer, he used to come to the set and get us all going and, you know, got our energy up so that when we filmed, we really, that was, you know, you can't fake that. That was real. And there's a great chemistry between the cast. And it was just fun.
30 albums, over a dozen movies, TV, tours. Your charity work is also endless. And I know, you know, you're fighting your third bout with cancer, stage 4, at your hospital. And I want folks to understand this. Like, your hospital, you built this back in 2008 with the goal to have a place for people to have rest and peace who are dealing with cancer. That's amazing to me.
Yeah, well, you know, they approached me to... help build this cancer center. And I had breast cancer, of course, before that. So I asked my mom what she thought of it. And she said, "Darling, if you can help people, you should do it." So that was all I needed. So I started this fundraising, and I had no idea how I was going to raise over $100 million to build this cancer wellness center. And, of course, I had a lot of help, and we went to government, and I sang "Honestly Love You" to the treasurer, and he gave me, like, $20 million.
I'd do that, too, by the way. If I had it, I'd be shelling out that cash, too, if you sang that to me.
But I decided that I would be involved in the cancer center if they would build a wellness center, because when I went through breast cancer the first time in 92, I was able to myself... help myself with herbs and homeopathy and acupuncture and meditation and all these different things to support my immune system and my heart and my spirit.
Sure, both.
So I said to them, "I will be happy to help you with this hospital if we can have a wellness center," that was unheard of in a public hospital at the time.
Absolutely.
So we actually did it, and it's open. And all the things that I have been fighting for and that were important to me, like art therapy and music therapy and you know, massages in the room for your feet and hands. I was able to experience that myself last September. And it was incredible to think that all those years of raising that money and fighting for this wellness center that is now kind of included in the whole cancer hospital was real. And I was experiencing it. And it was fantastic. It really was.
And I will tell you, positive thoughts and prayers are with you. I cannot tell you how much I love your book, and it always puts absolutely, and it always puts a smile on my face and millions of others when we hear your music, watch your music, and it's a beautiful gift we've been so lucky to have in our lives all this time.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you.
And we barely scratched the surface of Olivia's new book. It's called Don't Stop Believing. It's available wherever books are sold. And to keep up with Olivia, find her on Facebook and check her out online at olivianewton-john.com. Olivia, special time spent with you tonight, and thank you so much for doing this, and be well, my friend.
Thank you. Lovely talking to you.
Talking to you as well. All right, it's 720 okay. WGN. Bye-bye.
Flyers' favorite conversations of the year continues on 720 WGN.
Hi, you guys. I'm packing my stuff.
What's all this stuff doing now? You aren't going camping till Saturday.
I know, but I want to make sure I don't forget anything. Not this time.
What's so special about this time?
Well, it's my first overnight camp out with just the guys.
Hey, come on, you guys. Let's play free throws in the wastebasket.
We better not. Mom will get mad.
No, she won't. Nobody's home. Set it up again.
Big Pete Brady intercepts and goes for a shot. Oh, no.
Mom's favorite vase.
She always says, don't play ball in the house.
Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Dave.
So glad to have you on the show. You know, I know how close you are to your TV siblings, but I must say, you're the Brady that looks exactly the same that he did 50 years ago.
You know, Dave, I think you're crazy. But okay, thank you, I think.
Do I need glasses?
It has been 50 years. I think that we all, as we all age, we all miss the aging that is going on around us. And at least I look, I guess, I'm a good representation of what I used to be still.
Yeah,
but I have a, believe me.
You look good, brother. 50 years, you know, and I know you have never turned your back on the show for all these years. You've embraced it, but 50 years, quite a milestone.
Yeah, kind of wild, you know, and as people look back on this, it's almost as though we knew this was going to occur. So our view and our opinions of the time are so totally different than what people assume it must have been. We look back on this thing having taken place or rolled out over 50 years, that in some way we always knew it was going to be like that. But when we were on the air, we were struggling to stay on the air. Yeah, we were picked up only in one season, I believe it was season four, for an entire season. All other seasons, we were picked up for a half a season, the first half and then the second half, first half and then second half. And you're always waiting to hear whether or not you rated well enough for the network to pick you up.
That's amazing.
We knew we were in the mix. We were a show with a 30 share, which meant that 30% of the country was watching, the 30% of the television audience was watching us on Friday night, which is huge compared
Massive.
To today.
Absolutely.
And that would have been at the time about 30 million people. But still, that placed us in, you know, about 28, 29, 30. When you're looking at top 10 or top 20 shows, we wouldn't have made that. We would have made, at times, top 30. So, yeah, we've become part of the American tapestry, if you will. Maybe we are now the quintessential representation of American family, but it's taken 50 years to sort of assume that esteemed position.
You know, and I'm old enough to remember the show on Friday nights, you know, being on at like Friday nights at 7 o'clock or whatever it was. But once it hit syndication, and I think that's probably when I and my siblings really discovered the show and now can recite every line from every single cast member and every single episode. It was really syndication and all those years in the 70s, 80s and Nick at Night and everything else that really made it take off.
It has not ever been off the air
right,
in the 50 years. And it's been, as I understand, dubbed into or translated into 16 different languages. And wow. So to other cultures, we are sort of what America is in a family. And I know I'm constantly being reminded by individuals who didn't speak English or speak English as a second language that they learned English as a child by watching the show.
From watching the show. That's
that makes
awesome.
Sense because it's rather simple.
Yeah.
And it's children their age speaking English. I guess it's truly effective as a learning tool.
And you did some acting before this show. I mean, you were on Mannix, I think, was one of the episodes that you were on. So you did a little bit of acting, but I know there was like 250 kids that auditioned for this role, right?
I did a little bit of acting. I did very little, though, with respect to, like, having dialogue. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of commercials. But the dialogue thing was a little challenging for me. Yeah, I would learn later in life that I was hyperactive, you know, and dyslexic, and that sequence order issue of dyslexia not only affects your reading, but it affects your speech at times too, especially when you're under stress. And though I didn't think anyone was putting me under duress, there was, you know, the issue to perform that required me to get the words out in the correct order, which meant I couldn't, you know, they'd all come out at the same time. So that was a struggle for me as a kid. Others had much more acting, if you will, experience. Luckily for me, Sherb wasn't really looking for actors. He was looking for kids who could act. And what he was looking for is, in essence, he was looking for a kid who, when they got in front of the camera, remained a kid, a real a real child, but somebody who also they could expect would get the work done in the time frame. And I know that when they had apprehensions about it, they clearly figured out over time, over the first couple episodes, that I wouldn't say my abilities were limited, but that I needed my own way of working. And so there was one episode in that first season that was written around Peter. And I now look back at it and realize what they were wondering is whether he could handle it or not. And that was the hero episode.
Yeah.
And it actually settled me down. The additional attention, because mostly what happens when you're a kid, you get your script the day before you start filming. We film over 3 days. They break the script down into, you know, about 10 pages, about 30 pages in the script. So 10 pages, 10 pages, 10 pages over 3 days. And you're on, you know, a number of those pages. Of course, if it's your episode, you're on a lot of those pages.
Sure.
Normally, you would just go home and you'd be memorizing your lines with your parents. And the joke is, you know, if you want to find a good kid actor, find a parent who's a good actor, because the kid is going to parrot the line reading that their parent gives them the night before.
Sure.
That's what they're going to memorize. But when it came down to this episode, they saw a need to have the dialogue coach spend extra time with me. And that really, that time and that attention really, really helped. And as a result, it sort of, from that point forward, any time a kid had, or one of us had, or were featured in a particular episode, this was a tactic that was used on everyone, so that there was extra attention given not just by mom and dad, but by members of production to prepare the child for, you know, big hunks of dialogue and so forth that weren't normally there episode after.
Well, it gave you a greater level of confidence, obviously.
Absolutely, because it wasn't like it was a cold start. You'd been working already, and it's the way actors work when they're adults.
Sure.
It was paying respect, and I came alive with that kind of attention and validity, I suspect.
Well, and then there was such great chemistry between all of you, so I have to think that, you know, especially that first season, doing all that brought you so much closer together, but you also created a lot of great friendships on this show that have lasted a lifetime, Chris.
50 years, 51 at this point. We did the pilot a year before the series was on the air, so it's now, we did the pilot in September and October of 68, so that's been 51 years. And other than my own brother and sister, there's no one on this planet whom I've maintained a relationship with longer than my Brady Sips.
That's great. That's great. I was watching an old interview of Ann B. Davis, because I'm a big dork. It was from 25 years ago on Conan O'Brien. And she said when she was on the show, because she was single all of her life, but when she was on the show, she owned three different Porsches. And I thought, man, that's really blurring the lines for me to know that Alice was driving a Porsche, you know, during the series.
He had a little 914, I remember.
Yeah, exactly, exactly, exactly.
And she would, and, you know, so here's Ann B. Davis, you think about it.
Yeah.
So a Porsche, and she always had tennis shoes on and a tennis racket in her hand, beating a tennis ball when she wasn't working against the wall of the soundstage.
That's awesome. I love that. I love that. I love that. Well, so here comes the gathering of the Brady Kids for yet another series, but this one focuses on another star of the show itself, and that was the iconic house. And we'll talk about that next with Christopher Knight, Peter Brady from the Brady Bunch, next on 720 WGN.
Hi, Mom. Hi, Alice. What's for dinner?
Pork chops.
Pork chops. Huh? What else?
Applesauce?
Pork chops and applesauce. I mean, that's swell.
Everybody's smiling, sunshine day. Everybody's laughing, sunshine day.
So, Chris, considering the Bradys had six kids, Dad's an architect, they were apparently wealthy enough to employ a live-in maid, take great vacations, not have Carol work, but the boys shared a room and a girl shared a room. A little tight, I would say, for the budget.
You know, I guess, yeah, there was no room for Greg, finally, when he moved out. He had moved into the attic.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Obviously, and if you really think about it, the house for that many people, the kitchen wasn't very big, but back in that day, kitchens weren't lavished over as they are today. So,
right. So the Brady residence in North Hollywood is reportedly the second most photographed home in the U.S. after the White House.
I hear. I don't know who keeps these statistics, but if that statistic is correct, it pretty much blows me away. But there are that many cars over the course of an afternoon that will drive by and stop and take photographs.
And what's really funny,
now we've taken the time to actually return it to its former glory.
It's actually right down the street from the Cunningham House from Happy Days, which is pretty wild. But it was sold like a year ago. It was sold to HGTV for $3.4 million. And when HGTV came to you and the rest of the cast to say, we're going to rehab this house to look like it did on the set inside the house, because first of all, it looked nothing like that on the inside. I mean, you were on a soundstage.
You got to watch that first episode when we stepped through that door. Clearly, we all knew that it wasn't the house that we worked in, frankly. And what the audience will discover is that none of us even knew where this house was. It wasn't a part of our world. And though it is the second most photographed house in America, we had no intersection with it.
That's right.
America uses it sort of as their portal into Brady, because that's how the show used that photograph of that house. But that was just a house that was, you know, found in a neighborhood, you know, with the rights to take a photo that could run on a television series, because it could conceivably be the outside of the Brady house. It's not as though they saw that house, took a picture of it, and then went and built a set that could be the inside of that house.
Right.
Matter of fact, if you think about it, that house can't really be the Brady house.
Well, it is now.
And then when you open that front door in this first episode of the Barry Brady renovation, you'll see just how much that house isn't the house that we lived in.
So now all you guys...
And therein lies the not just the plot line, but the struggle. You know, how do you take essentially a split-level, one-story house and turn it into this two-story Brady house, which isn't small? I didn't really get it initially. I knew what, you know, we've got a Brady house that isn't the Brady house. We had a Brady house to us that wasn't really a house at all.
Right.
And now we're going to try to make both of them come together. And I thought, oh, it's an opportunity to reimagine the Brady house using modern, you know, appliances and technology and materials. That's not at all what they had in mind. Of course, HGTV's idea was far superior to mine. I was thinking about a house that at the end would be a house that anyone today would want to live in. I skipped right on over the entire opportunity to create a museum of this Brady house, and to the point where even furniture that was in a room needed to be found.
Yeah, right.
Of course, you have to have the dining room table, and they found the dining room table. I believe it's either one of the same models or it actually was the same dining table and chairs that we had. Some pieces are like that. But most, if we couldn't find the piece, we remade the furniture.
Yeah, amazing.
We didn't build just the house. We remade the furniture.
And
one of the trickiest aspects was the color.
Yeah.
Getting the colors right.
So you can, until Wednesday, September 11th, the Brady Bunch superfans can submit their grooviest, most creative video that shares why they deserve to win the ultimate Brady fan prize, a six-night stay at the Brady Bunch house in Los Angeles from the 9th through the 15th of December. How cool is that?
It's fantastically cool. If you're a Brady fan, to get to live in this house, we haven't had a chance to actually stay overnight yet in the house. So I can't wait to find find out who it is that presents their explanation of why it's necessary for them to have, you know, this stay in the Brady House. It's a 30 to 90 second video that they submit. These are going to be a lot of fun for us to watch. But you know, it's a very special stay, not only in the Brady House, but in L.A. $25,000 is also being given away to the winner.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
For eight runner-ups, they're each making or being gifted with $500. So, and again, the contest is open till September 11th. I understand HGTV has already received hundreds of videos. It is a special place.
Absolutely.
And if you're a Brady fan, submit your video.
Well, you can catch the entire project, and that's only on HGTV and HGTV.com. This sounds very cool. I'm totally looking forward to watching this, Chris. It's Christopher Knight. He played Peter Brady on the Brady Bunch. I know you had your hand in a lot of this, too, so it's going to be a lot of fun watching this all come together.
Enjoy.
Thanks, Chris.
It is special.
All right, thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Dave.
All right, top stories are next on 720 WGN. So I'm walking into my local bakery, you know, so they usually have news on the radio. And I said, so what's the deal with the music? And they said, well, it's Sinatra Sunday. And they were 28 years old to 32 years old, sitting in, having a cup of coffee, listening to a little Frank. They said it's the best way to ease into their day.
Now, this could only happen to a guy like me. And only happen in a town like this.
Yeah, it goes well with your coffee while you're making pancakes, hanging out, reading the paper on your iPad. Is ease your way into a Sunday morning with the sounds of Frank Sinatra.
This is my kind of town, Chicago is.
The show is called The Sinatra Hours. It is a guilty pleasure just sharing a little Frank Sinatra with our audience.
I shine all day Sunday, that one day when I'm with you.
Plus a little bit of the stories behind Frank's legacy.
We just finished the show. Frank got standing ovation after standing ovation. He came off stage and said, let's go, Tommy. We jumped in the limo, squad cars and limousines, rushed us to the jet. Moments later, we're flying over the venue, heading for Chicago, you know, going to the Chicago Theater. And Frank's talking. He said, we're going to go to the Chicago Theater, Tom. I love Chicago. He's telling me much about Chicago. He said, we're going to knock him dead.
My kind of town, Chicago.
This is appointment setting stuff. People will be listening every single weekend.
Don't you know, little fool?
Yeah, they're going to get into a habit to listen to some of the classics that they know well. They can sing along, they can play along, they can, you know, it's all in their head. And it's the perfect vibe for that time of the week.
Cause I've got you under my.
I'm Dave Plyer. The show is called The Sinatra Hours. It'll happen every Sunday morning, 6:30 to 9. And I'd be thrilled if you came along with us.
Before we tell you about the 2020 WGN Chicago calendars, we want to say thank you, Chicagoland. For the past decade, you've been loyal supporters of these exclusive WGN Chicago calendars, but sadly, the time has come to retire the line. So in honor of that, 2Ks has crafted the 2020 calendar to be the best ever. It is a true commemorative edition. For this final compilation, we've selected the 12 best Chicago images from prior years and made it even more elegant, featuring best-in-class materials. Each calendar is made to order with a personalized name in every image. Wall and desk calendars with special date personalization available as well. This timeless keepsake is a must-have for fans of these calendars, for business associates, friends, and family. This final commemorative edition is a celebration of Chicagoland and the legacy of these calendars. Own a piece of history. Go to WGNradio.com and scroll to the feature section to order your calendar today. That's WGNradio.com. Scroll to the feature section and order now.
Dave Plyer's favorite conversations of the year continues on 720 WGN.
This program was recorded earlier so that we'd have time for a solo by Sammy Davis Jr.
You can testify, but you just can't win, because I'm here to tell you, you guilty as sin. Here comes the judge. Here comes the judge. Here comes the judge.
One ringy ding. A gracious good afternoon. Is this the party who has answered my call? The Central Intelligence Agency? Good. This is Miss Tomlin of the phone company. Well, of course I know your phone was off the hook. Isn't it amazing the way we can still make it ring?
NBC. Beautiful downtown Burbank. Oh, hello, Governor Rockefeller. Oh, no. I don't think we could get Mr. Nixon to stand still for a socket to me.
Socket to me?
The past decade, we gave new meanings to old words and phrases.
I get it. Hey, once when we said, that's my bag, we were claiming our luggage.
That's right. I think you're onto it, Milhouse. Let's hear a little of some of the other language changes that occurred in the 60s.
I can remember when soul was something everybody had.
It used to be that grass was something you paid a kid $2 to mow.
Freak out was a sign that told you the circus sideshow was closed for lunch.
A bad trip was when it rained on your vacation.
Turn on was something you did to a radio. The good things to radios.
The fuzz was something that grew on peaches and teenagers.
A little pot was something to boil an egg in.
Remember when the only person who put you down was your babysitter?
And an upper was a cheap Pullman ticket.
And a bad scene was something you'd walk out of a play for.
Very interesting, but thoroughly supercilious.
Dave Blair on 720 WGN. So Saturday Night Live may have debuted on NBC in October 1975, but much of its roots originated from the network's Laugh-In, which premiered January 22nd, 1968. Surrounded by sets decorated with go-go dancers, cocktail parties, and joke walls, a young, cute, happy, and fun cast delivered a new blueprint for generating laughter. Roland Martin's Laugh-In, which originally ran from 68 to 73, is getting a star-studded 50th anniversary tribute on Netflix, premiering this Tuesday, May 14th. It's called Still Laughin', The Stars Celebrate, and it'll include Laugh-In cast members Lily Tomlin, Joanne Worley, as well as director, producer, and creator George Schlatter. Now, throughout his long and successful career as a producer and writer, George has been responsible for hundreds of hours of television series and specials. He, of course, changed the face of television when he created and produced Laugh-In. And to talk about this legendary series, George Schlatter joins us tonight. Good evening, George.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for the nice word.
Absolutely. Thrilled to have you join us tonight. And, you know, before we talk about Laugh-In and this upcoming Netflix special, I want to step back a bit and talk about how you got into television. Your family had more of a musical background, and music was a big part of your early life.
Yeah, my mother was a concert violinist. My aunt was a concert pianist. And I was the youngest singer with the St. Louis Municipal Opera Company.
Wow. Wow.
Yep.
Wow. Well, and from a musical perspective, you know, you were also exposed early on to live entertainment and variety acts, and that quickly translated into your love of television and the live nature of delivery to viewers.
Well, I got lucky. That was what it was. I think I failed at everything else. No, it was like I was doing the Dinosaur Chevrolet show when she went into color, and Dinah wanted to do more comedy, and so I became the producer of the Dinosaur Chevy show when I was about 20 years old, and then I just got lucky.
Well, you first
That's pretty much it. You got a large amount of luck in my resume.
Well, you first worked for MCA, booking bands and acts, which kind of led you to various jobs, obviously, in Vegas, so that's how you got your foot into show business. But that Dinah Shore Chevy show that you were talking about, that show was like live theater every week. It was like 39, you know, right now, well, what are we doing? 10 episodes, 7 episodes, 13 episodes. It was 39 live shows a year.
That's right. That's right. And then 13 non-Dinahs. And they were the show when Dinah had a week off to rest.
Ah, the summer
and
shows.
I got started doing the non-Dinahs, and then Dinah wanted to do more comedy, and I had worked with all of the comics in Vegas and at Ciro's on the Frontier and so forth, and so I was the logical choice to come in and bring some comedy, and it was all the Still Silvers and, you know, Danny Thomas and Bob Hope and all of that. So it was a long and bumpy road that led me to your station in Chicago.
Ah, that's funny. You know, and that show, though, you know, it must have laid the groundwork for you as a producer, because you got to, you know, you got to put your arms around that show and work with a lot of the greats besides Dinah in the show every single week. But that must have laid the groundwork for, you know, how you produced other shows over the next five decades.
Well, it did. It was that, and then my minimal attention span counted for the brevity.
Okay.
But it was just, some of them, it was all the same. Pretty much everybody was doing the same show, and I kind of got bored with it, and I had all of these friends of mine who were working saloons and nightclubs and comics, you know, comedy clubs. And I collected them all, and we put them all together into one huge pile of laughter.
You did. No, you absolutely did. After that show, and by the way, you were producing, you kind of brought your love of the music business and television together when you produced the Grammys for years.
Yes, I did the best on record. Boy, you did a lot of research, didn't you?
I certainly did.
I'm impressed with me. So all of that led into this, and then the accident played a large part in everything. And NBC had the whatever it was, they were going to do the comedy. Oh God, it was a celebration. It was a big event that they have on NBC, and they didn't have anybody to put on the show. So I came in with an idea to put this collection of unusual, bizarre, talented, and funny people. We put them all together into one group. NBC looked at it and said, "This isn't a television show." I said, "Well, you laughed, and the audience is brighter than you are." So, and so we put it all together into these little bits and pieces, and they put it on the air really because they didn't have anything else to put on. And it happened, and the audience liked it before the network did.
Well, I was going to say,
so we got lucky.
This was a special that came out. They did it as a special at first in 67. And I know, you know, it was Rowan and Martin's laugh. And I know you knew Dan and Dick for years before that show. There was definitely magic with them. But why did you choose them?
Well, the show was originally designed, did not have a host. It just happened. And Timex, Jim Ellis at Timex, said he would do the show, but he wanted to have a host. So I'd worked with Dan and Dick, and so we went to them. They wore tuxedos, and they were a little older than the rest of the people, and they became the center. They became the post around which everything kind of revolved. And they were older, and they liked the idea of all of these young comics who were character comics. Artie Johnson did voices, and Ruth Buzzy did all of these characters, and Lily Tomlin did characters. Well, this way, this show, the design of this show, with all of these bits and pieces and brief little vignettes, was perfect for the talent that did multiple characters. So Lily Tomlin could do 6, 8, 10 characters in one show. So could Ruth Buzzy and Artie Johnson. And but it was a bizarre collection of people with these little bursts of crazy things.
You know, you talk about sponsors, and some of our younger listeners might not really get that, but I mean, the sponsors drove the car, man. They drove the train. If you had to please them in whatever you were doing, really for the first 20 plus years of television, it was all about the sponsor.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And but this, for the sponsors, we could do sponsor jokes, and we could do jokes. We had integrated the sponsors into the show, and it broke a lot of rules. We had rules then just would go on for days, and a woman by the name of Carolyn Raskin invented much of the editing techniques that allowed us to do laughing with these little short pieces because we didn't have the technology that we have today. And so we just put it together. She put it together in these little bursts. And we ran it for the network, and they said, "But that's not a television show." We said, "No, but you laughed, and the
right,
audience
right.
is brighter than you are." So they put it on, and nothing happened because there were no names on the show. You know?
Right.
It was all just these little young character people. And but it caused quite a stir, and eventually when it went on the air, after 3 or 4 weeks, it just kind of exploded. And the audience was ready for something new and unique, and nothing had happened other than just pretty much theater and nightclub style of comedy. And so when this came on, the audience was waiting for something different, and this was it.
Yeah, that was it. Well, and you were up against, I was looking at what you were up against at that time, and you pretty much were in the same Monday night time slot for the entire time, which is pretty pretty unusual, too.
That was a big battle we had with NBC. NBC said they wanted to put it on later so there wouldn't be as many problems because we had trouble with censors and sponsors and so forth. And I just wouldn't do it later, so it stayed on Monday night at 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
And it was appointment television.
It was. You were up against Gunsmoke and Here's Lucy. I mean, big ratings.
Well, see, the one other thing, it was Gunsmoke and Lucy were number one and number two.
Right.
And NBC had nothing to put on Monday night at 8 o'clock.
No. And Jeannie was your lead-in. I think Jeannie.
Cannon fodder. Yeah. They put us on knowing that nothing would happen, but they had nothing else that they wanted to put on that they were willing to sacrifice. So we went on the air. And nobody really gave us much of a glance, even though I had no hope at all. But after the third week or so, people began to talk about it. And then Sammy Davis came on and did Here Come the Judge. And
exploded.
It just took off.
Yeah, it did. Even though, you know, you talk about how edgy and contemporary that show was, it looked very current, of course, for the time. But it also seems like you took some inspiration from earlier variety shows, some of the vaudeville shows, when you were putting this together, because it was such a mishmash of talent.
Yeah, it was. It was. But I'd grown up and worked a lot in saloons with the comics that were doing it. You know, but they were all stand-up comics. But we didn't have any way at that point to put them together. So we put them all together and we taped and taped and taped and then edited. Carolyn Raskin edited all of that together, and it came out as television for the, not for the blind, but for the attention challenged.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it, but it was a delight to do because we came into the studio and we could do anything we wanted to and for as long as it worked. And then we came in with a big script and we would tape everything and then Carolyn Raskin would put it all together. And some of the early shows were a real adventure, and nobody could really understand what we were doing, including me. But it was
wow.
Just my own short attention span and a wonderful British writer by the name of Digby Wolfe. And then when you took Artie Johnson and Ruth Buzzy and Joanne Worley and Goldie Hawn and Lily Tomlin, those people, and you put them all into the studio, then we would come in with a script, and then we would also play. If anything happened, we kept it in. So when we got all through, it was 1 hour of just a bunch of adult children.
Mayhem, absolutely. And you know, I was thinking, too, about the times of this thing, because, you know, 1968, Vietnam was at the forefront. President Johnson, I'm not running for president again. Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy assassinated. You were kind of providing a much-needed break from all that was happening around us.
Well, the strange thing is, the new show that we did, the Still Laugh and the collection of the anniversary, the same issues we were talking about in 1966, 67, 68, 69 exist today. An unpopular war, an unpopular president, all of that, we haven't fixed anything. So everything that we did then relates to relates to today. And since nobody was doing comedy about it, and since we didn't do anything long enough for everybody to get really nervous, we went on relatively unnoticed because we were cannon fodder. We were just a show that they were putting on the air until they could get a real show ready.
right.
So we went on, and we would come into the studio, and we would tape till 2, 3 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
And then Carolyn would go downstairs and just put all of this together. And it got on the air usually at the last minute. And before they figured out what we were doing, the audience figured out that they liked it. And so it just took off. And the numbers became astronomical.
They
couldn't believe it was getting the ratings it got.
No, and there's never going to be any show like that. I mean, you're getting 50 million people watching a show like that. You could never do that today. I mean, that itself is an era gone by.
Well, they would never let it happen. I mean, we did the show with very little parental supervision, and so we would come in and we would tape, and if Artie Johnson announced and came in with the character, we'd put it on. And sometimes when we didn't have anything ready, Artie would stand at the piano and make up a song. And Ruth Buzzy would come in and do just a character. And we would then do interview Lily Tomlin as a five-year-old.
Right.
And then we would have Goldie. We would put Goldie out there and give her complicated speeches. And when she got screwed up, that was what we used.
That was Golden. That was Golden.
And that was Goldie. It was an adventure we did. It was an adult playpen, and fortunately it worked. And by the time it took off and we got these huge, huge numbers, then the network couldn't say anything about it, you know, because this is 50 years ago, I was arrogant. I mean, I'm arrogant now, but if you can imagine me with a 50 share, forget about it.
Yeah, right, exactly. As a 30-something guy doing this, of course. I don't think any series has matched in terms of hyper-speed, outrageousness, offbeat sensibility than Laugh-In.
Well, true, partially because of the characters we had. You know, they were so bright and so creative and so inventive. And then partially because of the time when everybody was nervous. And then, see, we were taping that stuff sometimes in the middle of the night. We taped some of that 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, the stuff with the joke wall, you know?
Yeah.
That we would do maybe 1 o'clock in the morning. And we had very little parental supervision at that hour. So we would do whatever we wanted and then put it on the air. And usually it went on the air often that same night.
That's crazy. That's even crazier.
There was no time for them to fix it, you know?
That's great. And that is
somehow or another, we've gotten so many rules now. We don't have the same walls as far as taste, which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
And language, so that's unfortunate. We obeyed all the rules, but very selectively.
That's true. Yeah, no, that's awesome. And I can't wait to see this. Again, it's called Laugh-In. Still Laugh-In, the stars celebrate. It'll include original cast members Lily Tomlin, Joanne Worley, as well as our guest tonight, George Schlatter. And it's a star-studded 50th anniversary tribute that's going to be on Netflix, all in tribute to Laugh-In. George, I have to tell you, what a great pleasure it has been spending some time with you.
I've enjoyed this. Listen, take a look at the show and let me know what you think.
I'll do that.
You got to be sure you're sitting down and shut down the phone.
Focused.
Don't have anything in it. Don't tell your children not to interrupt you and kind of pay attention to it. I think you'll enjoy it.
I'm sure I will.
Hopefully you'll understand a lot of it.
I'm sure I will. Can't wait to see it, sir.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be right back after this on 720 WGN.
This week on Chicago's Best, for some, getting rid of grains is a choice. For others, it's a lifestyle. Chicago's Best is going gluten-free Sunday night at 10 on WGN-TV.
Welcome back to my favorite conversations of the year. I'm Dave Plyer. Larry Potash from WGN-TV Morning News co-hosted a show with me earlier this year, along with comedian Mike Toomey, and we talked about classic TV. Let's take a listen.
Did I sigh?
Yeah, you sighed, and you heaved it right over this direction. Like trying to eat in a wind tunnel.
I'm sorry. I must have done it unconscious.
It's the way you go through life.
All I hear all day long at school is how great Marcia is at this or how wonderful Marcia did that. Marcia, Marcia, Marcia.
This happens to be a list of the qualifications of a perfect wife. All right, 1, good listener.
Yeah.
2, good sense of humor.
Yeah.
3, no mustache.
No.
4, and this is a biggie, must be untried.
Oh, right, untried.
5.
What's untried? Dummy. It means she's never been in court.
It means that she's got to be pure. She's got to be a virgin.
Virgin.
5. A high school diploma or equivalency. 6.
Fonz, don't get mad, but how can you be sure about that, well, the number 4?
Yeah.
About her being a virgin?
Yeah.
She told me. 6.
Well, couldn't she have lied?
Come here. Virgins don't lie. These days are
happy days. Larry Potash hosting, Dave Plyer here.
Hey, buddy.
Thanks for having me in today.
Yeah.
And we have my colleague, the very funny Mike Toomey, on the line. Hey, Mike.
Hey, guys, you forgot pork chops and applesauce.
Oh, I did. Son of a.
How many weeks were we going around school doing that?
And you know what my favorite line is from the Brady Bunch?
Yes.
It may be the in thing for teenagers to call their parents by their first names, but around here, we are still mom and dad.
They're not sunglasses, they're shades. We could go on like the next 3 hours like this.
My son wants to be an architect because of Mike Brady.
Right. But he designed a house with one bathroom, so that's, you know.
That's true. I forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah, did you? Robert Reed, some people don't know, who played Mike Brady, is from Highland Park.
No, I did not know
that.
Exactly, yeah. He was.
Chicago's very.
And he also played John Travolta's dad in Boy in the Plastic Bubble.
Did he really?
Yes.
He was on The Defenders or something, too. It was some crime drama before The Brady Bunch. Was he real serious?
He was. And he actually had a role that. Was ahead of its time. He was on an episode of Medical Center where he was a patient who went through a sex change.
Wow. 60s.
Yeah.
Early, maybe like 1970.
If you don't know, Mike's a comedian who does a one-man show about 70s TV,
and
it is unbelievable.
Brady Bunch, who was originally scheduled to play Mike Brady and Mrs. Brady? Do you remember? Ever reading that?
I know Joyce Bulifant was supposed to have played Carol, correct?
Mm-hmm. Murray's wife from the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
And then Mike Brady was like a pretty famous actor. Don't tell me it was not James Caan, but somebody along those lines, right?
I think it was Gene Hackman.
It was Gene Hackman.
Yeah.
Gene Hackman, that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the kind of knowledge that Mike and I carry with us in our heads.
Next 3 hours.
In case you wonder what people were talking about during commercial breaks.
Right. So I did this piece, Mike will remember, Mike helped me with this piece called That 70s Class, and there was a professor named John Tenuto, I think it's Lake County Community College, who was teaching this class about the importance of pop culture through the 70s or something like that, and I think we have John on the line. John, are you there?
I'm here, guys. How you doing?
Hey, thanks for joining us.
It's a reunion.
You know what was interesting in this piece, John, and then maybe you can explain, is, you know, back in the day, All in the Family got super huge ratings, right? And you remember the things they talked about in All in the Family and the things they would say. You could not say those things and deal with those themes on TV today. And you explained why, and I thought that was very interesting.
Oh, yeah, it's interesting. You know, if you watch even like the Dean Martin roasts and things like that back then, or even Welcome Back, Kotter, which was a softer show than All in the Family, they really dealt with issues in kind of a raw way, but they were able to get away with it, almost like animation is today, because the sets weren't very realistic and the settings and so on. You could hear the audience, and you really got a sense that you were watching almost like a stage play, and it was sort of fake. And by it being fake in a way, they could be more real, if that makes any sense. Whereas today's shows are so realistic that if they start touching on those issues, we get offended kind of quickly.
That is fascinating. And you're a Star Trek guy, right?
Oh, yeah, Star Trek, and love, 70s, 80s sitcoms and Star Wars, all that.
But you were talking
anything
about
popular culture.
You were talking earlier about the whole watching things together and having something communal to do, and like those water cooler moments of watching television when 60 million people were watching All
the
Family.
That's what Mike was saying, that, you know, you'd hear a catchphrase, right? One of the many catchphrases.
So many catchphrases. Welcome Back, Carter. Happy Days. I mean, how many catchphrases came from Happy Days? You know, sit on it and wah, 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 and hey. You know, I mean, there's like 100 catchphrases that started from Happy Days.
Right. And now we don't have the only appointment viewing, John, is like, the Super Bowl and the Oscars.
Yeah, when you think of sort of the decades since we did that piece together, the streaming technology has really changed everything. And so that, you know, when we were kids, we were watching 3 hours of TV a day, too. And kids today are doing more. I think the average is 3 hours for a 16 to 24-year-old just with social media.
Wow.
But that's a really individual thing. And although we might have watched the shows by ourselves, the next day we were all at school and everybody had seen the same show as us. So it became a social thing after the the fact. But today, it's really individualized, and it's really separating the kids from one another. They don't talk as much with one another. I'm seeing that in class quite a bit.
So Mike, what
we also had.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm going to say we also had fewer choices. I mean, there were four channels plus UHF. I mean, chances are you show up the next day, everybody has seen the same thing that you have.
Yeah. Mike, what was the show? Give me a show that holds up and give me a show that doesn't hold up.
Wow.
In terms of, I'll give you mine. I'll give you time to think about it. I'll give John a time to think about it because I just kind of stumbled upon this. I watched Welcome Back, Carter one day and I thought, this is the dumbest,
terrible,
most unfunny, terrible show. Yeah. It felt like my childhood was a lie because I thought, you know, when you're eight, it's hilarious.
Yeah, of course.
And then Kojak. Kojak was also terrible. It was like watching an episode of Naked Gun, but there was no comedy in it.
Right. There's some things you go back and watching. You know, I mentioned Happy Days earlier. The first few seasons of that show hold up rather well, and people use that measuring stick of Fonzie jumping the shark, but that really, really was the defining moment in that show. When you watch anything that happened after that, it was horrible. You know, Fonzie's like fighting the devil. You know?
Before,
he was just a guy with a jacket who could kick a Coke machine to make a drink come out. Now he's, you know,
taking on aliens.
It was
an alien one. Robin Williams, right?
I very sadly was watching in the middle of the night when I couldn't sleep an episode of Cannon. With William Conrad, and he was like wearing a leisure suit, and his pants were like the Fred Mertz pants. It was like his were all the way up to the middle of his chest, and he was in
a powder blue LTD.
And he was in a bar like he was this stud, and he was picking up these like young blondes in the bar because everybody wanted to talk to Cannon because he was a crime fighter or whatever. Yeah. And I'm thinking, oh man, does not work for me. Yeah.
And how is he catching anybody? The guy's like 700 pounds. Yeah. You know? He's like, get free, Sopper, I'll throw a sandwich at you.
John, what's your show that holds up and one that doesn't?
Well, I got to say, like, the whole Mary Tyler Moore universe holds up really well. Mary Tyler Moore, Bob Absolutely. Newhart, all right. Those shows, I think those are still funny. I'd say Sanford and Son really holds up. It's still funny. We showed it to our 15-year-old, 16-year-old, it took about a year for us to get through Sanford and Son, but he was laughing like it was a brand new show. So that was kind of interesting to see his reaction. But I think Love Boat. Love Boat is great for us because we get to see all these people we grew up with on the show. But when I watch it through my son's eyes, he doesn't understand even the concept of the show. I mean, it's a very weird show. It's a very weird show out of its time, I think.
It's Love on a Boat. What doesn't the kid understand?
See, now I think the Dick Van Dyke Show, that show, one of the older shows, Black and White, stands up. I mean, it's still funny from front to back. The Dick Van Dyke Show. The one I couldn't stand was Gilligan's Island. Like that one, if you try to watch it today.
That's bad.
Oh, it's bad.
MASH is good. MASH holds up.
Yeah.
It's funny because we went really far back.
When it was current.
We went really far back with our son and showed him all of the Father Knows Bests. And it was interesting watching it now because that show, you know, they were almost 27 minutes long. And they would do just one A story. And now you watch something like Young Sheldon, there's like three plots in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's really, you could see the type of writing was so much better in the past because they had to sustain that interest for longer.
Yeah. John, before I let you go, you got something going on in your world that you want to plug or anything?
That'd be great. Sure. Next Saturday, March 16th, we're going to be at the Cook Memorial Library. We're going to be giving a talk about the Star Wars radio dramas, which were done in the 1980s and helped and save NPR. And it's a really interesting history of Star Wars on the radio, believe it or not.
Wow, I didn't know that existed. Interesting. Yeah, that's good information. John, thanks for joining us. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, Michael.
Mike, yes.
You there. So you and I sometimes talk about Saturday morning cartoons, and that's something that our kids really miss out on because, of course, they can watch anything when they want to watch it.
Right.
Some cartoons better than others.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, if you remember, and we talked about this earlier, it was a point in our television. There was a point every fall they would do a Saturday morning preview on a Friday night.
Totally remember
and they
that.
Would show you the lineup and all the new things that were coming. And as a kid, I would like, I realize this now, I would like write them down. Okay, I'm going to switch over to Channel 5 at this time. I'm going to switch over to, you know, Channel 2 at this time. And it was like, it was appointment viewing. It was, you know, now there's
channels that show nothing but cartoons 24 hours a day. And it seemed like it was way more fun back then.
It was a big choice between Jabberjaw and Baggy Pants and the Nitwits.
The Funky Phantom.
The Funky Phantom, yeah, yeah. Hong Kong Fooey. Super Friends, I think, was kind of the gold standard.
That was pretty cool, yeah. And Scooby-Doo was always reliable. Yeah.
And Scooby-Doo was like, they would change it up every year. They have a different, I talk about this in my show. Season, they'd meet celebrities. It was the weirdest thing. Like, today Scooby meets Phyllis Diller. Really? Phyllis Diller?
I forgot about that. Yeah.
Like an 8-year-old kid going, God, I hope it's the Phyllis Diller one this week. Or Sandy Duncan. I mean, honestly.
Who was the band that played the music for Fat Albert? Remember all the songs they used to sing?
Yeah.
I remember the songs. And I remember listening going, how come he doesn't sing like he talks?
Right, right. It's Bad Company, right?
No way.
Shooting Star. Someone call in and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think a few of the songs they sang, they were Bad Company songs, unless I'm mistaken, but somebody Google that for me. Hey, Mike, I wanted to ask you about Mr. Rogers, because you do a great Mr. Rogers impersonation, and I see it through an adult eyes, and I think about Lady Elaine, who ran the museum. I mean, think about it. I mean, she always had those red cheeks like she was hammered, and she had like the short, shaggy haircut. She was like a bag, and she was always pissed off. Like, what are you pissed about at the land of make-believe?
Right. Well, you know, Fred Rogers used to say about all the characters on his show that they were all extensions of his own personality.
Hmm.
So I don't know what part of Fred Rogers was Lady Elaine.
Was pissed off.
Yeah, it looked like she got slightly burned, like she got a little too close to to the stove when she was fixing the mac and cheese for somebody.
And there were two other weird things. There was, I don't know if you remember this, it wasn't featured that much on Mr. Rogers' Land of Make-Believe, but it was the little rodent who ran the factory, and he had a name like Cornelius Muffin Fudge. Do you remember that?
It was Cornflake Especially.
Yes, Cornflake Especially.
I couldn't pull that up.
But like, he would disappear for weeks like he was involved in some kind of sex scandal or something. I don't know.
Or he was, he was a recurring role. Maybe he was like auditioning for somebody. He wanted to have his own show, and then he kept coming back. Sorry, we don't really see a vehicle for Cornflake Especially. I think you should go back to Fred Rogers.
And then you remember there was this period where they were doing the Purple Pandas.
Yes.
And
they just kind of floated through the kingdom. Yeah.
And I'm thinking, are Sid and Marty Krofft like hanging out with Fred? Are they like doing some weed? Where do you get Purple Pandas in all of this?
They all had a meeting. Well, that whole kingdom was weird with King Friday and the welcome to the neighborhood of make-believe.
I just had
what was the other one? The Owl, X the Owl. Yeah. And, it was just a kind of an odd setup, but for sure.
I had Marty Krofft on the show, actually, about a month ago, talking about some of the stuff. Like the 50th anniversary, 67, of H.R. Puff and stuff. So those live-action shows on Saturday morning, I kind of look forward to those. Like, even though I watched, like, the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner Hour and Pink Panther and some of those were kind of anchors at the end of the morning, right?
Yeah, you knew
but
it was talking
about drug induced. Oh, yeah. I mean, Lidsville if that's not an acid trip, I don't know what is.
You knew it was getting late in the morning when the live action came on, right? They all came on at 10:30, 11.
Yeah. Shazam!
Right, time to go out and play as the Bugaloos are on.
But there was a banana split too.
The Shazam one, I liked the Shazam one. Remember that one where
you
drive around the country in a Winnebago?
Yeah. I mean, no sense to me. And Isis, right? Wasn't she part of that hour?
Yep.
The Shazam Isis hour.
Yeah.
Wow. What else do you talk about in your show, Mike?
Well, I talk about the stuff that I was watching, like when I was a kid, like all the Saturday morning cartoons. But then there was a couple after school cartoons. Like I remember, Speed Racer, which was one of the first Japanese cartoons that our generation kind of got into. And it was funny because you didn't really know where it was coming from when you watched it, because like they would talk so weird about speed, okay, got a racer, speed racer for me, got a racer. And it just seemed weird to you until you get to like the age that I am now, and I feel like that is me. Like, yeah. I'll drop something and go, oh, I dropped my keys. Like, ah, I forgot to say, I'm going to drop my glasses. I pick up my glasses. So I'm like living it now.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody's a killjoy here. They want to tell you that's from 708 that they loved Family Affair. Hello.
Family Affair was okay. It was just it was one of those shows that kind of didn't go nuclear. Family, you know, and Uncle Bill, the Playboy uncle, was raising the three kids.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
and Mr. French.
But my favorite was Mr. French. Sebastian Cabot was on that show.
That's right.
Yeah, and Uncle Bill was always hammered, right?
Oh, my God. Every time they talked to the guy, it was like he looked like he hadn't slept in 72 hours.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, he's like always rubbing his eyes, hey, Buffy, you want to go get my vodka?
You know, Darren was always drunk, too, on Bewitched. I mean, there was liquor that really kind of made it through all these 1960s series, right? And always the drunk at the bar.
Everybody.
Because he'd go up to the bar.
Had a bar in their house.
Yeah. He would go up to the bar, and Darren would say to the bartender, my wife's a witch, and then the drunk at the end of the bar, so is my mother-in-law.
Join the club.
Exactly. And that was WGN-TV's Larry Potash and Mike Toomey. Have a happy new year, everybody. News is next here on 720 WGN.